This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to the Maritimes This Week. I'm Rob Dublay. This is a podcast featuring the best of CBC radio programming from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island. On the podcast this week, you might just want to put the cornflakes away. Coming up, we're hunting for deer, and they're actually kind of easy to find. They're already dead.
Last night, I got called at home. There was an injured deer, and I went to go look at that, and it appeared to have a broken neck.
At the end of the show, we'll meet Wilf Creighton of Halifax. He was 13 years old on the day of the Halifax explosion 90 years ago. This week, he took two other 13-year-olds on a living history tour, and we'll tag along to hear what he has to say.
I was upstairs with a geography book in my lap. We were going to have a geography test in grade 8. All of a sudden, the house began to shake.
But coming up first on the podcast, Cape Breton is looking for some randy rodents? Well, if you're a red squirrel in Cape Breton, you're going to want to pay attention to this story. An old enemy is moving back into your neighborhood. And you know what? Don't think that you can be nice or make friends. This guy is out for blood. He is all business. CBC Cape Breton's Dave Atkinson brings us the story of the reintroduction of the American marten to the Cape Breton National Highlands Park.
A soft snow is just starting to fall.
Why don't you come around by the mess?
It's the first of the year, and after just a few minutes, the ground and trees in this forest clearing, the site of an old abandoned campground, are coated with white.
Go in there and hold your microphone close to the box. You may pick up.
James Bridgeland points out a wire cage settled a few meters into the woods. Inside, poking its fuzzy little face out of a wood box, is an American marten. Bridgeland is an ecologist at Cape Breton Highlands National Park.
Well, they are a small weasel-like animal. They are in the weasel family. They're larger than a weasel. They're about the same size as a mink or a little smaller. About the size of a small house cat, actually.
Bridgeland opens the door to the cage, but this fuzzy little guy is more interested in my microphone than in freedom. Look at him. He's a rich, tawny brown with big ears and a little pointy face. Surely he wouldn't mind if I try to pet him just a little. Okay. This marten is a top predator. He adorably devours squirrels, voles, and any other small mammal he happens to come across.
Snowshoe hare population is also coming up to a peak, so
he could catch a hare.
Believe it or not, yeah.
Because he would be half the size, maybe a third.
Yeah, about probably weighs about the same, maybe a little less, but certainly the hare is larger than he is, but he's pretty ferocious.
Meanness aside, the marten is a looker. And it's the beauty of its pelt that nearly wiped the population off Cape Breton Island.
Due to trapping and habitat fragmentation over the past century, their population has declined to the point that in the late 20th century, the population was down to fewer than 50 animals.
Barely enough for a size small women's jacket and matching gloves. Bridgeland says the Nova Scotia government banned trapping of marten here in the 1930s when it became clear how few there were left.
More recently, they've run into difficulties on account of the spruce budworm epidemic that ran through northern Cape Breton in the late 1970s, early 1980s, which took out a lot of the mature balsam fir forest that they relied upon for for cover and for prey. That's now starting to recover some of that forest, and but the marten have not come back with it yet. We suspect that what probably happened was that their numbers became so low that they hit a sort of a genetic bottleneck, and not only that, but the numbers were so low that they were having difficulty finding each other in order to breed.
This marten was trapped a few days ago in northern New Brunswick. He's part of a reintroduction plan Parks Canada developed with the Provincial Department of Natural Resources and local Mi'kmaq groups.
We picked New Brunswick because there are plenty of marten there. We had had some concerns initially that because of its island nature, the Cape Breton might have a population that was genetically distinct, similar to the population of martens in Newfoundland. But we did some genetic work comparing marten that we had found here with marten from across the Maritime provinces and eastern states and the mainland of Canada, and discovered that they were in fact part of a genetic population that ranges from the Gaspé and Maine and New Brunswick to mainland Nova Scotia. So that meant that we were able to capture marten from any part of that range to find animals to augment the population here.
Our talk of genetics and ecology must be boring this marten. He darts out of his box, past the leftover hare carcass, and out the door. He climbs on top of his cage, but before taking off, he stops. Translation: is it true what they say about marten females in Cape Breton? And with that, he's gone, off into the snowy woods. Bridgeland says he's got a good shot of making it. There's plenty of squirrel, vole, and hare to hunt, and the recovering fir forest offers shelter from predators like the great horned owl. Bridgeland and others will monitor the marten by radio collar and by counting fir samples collected in a baited contraption called a hare snag tube.
We plan to keep bringing in animals for the next 3 to 5 years until we've augmented the population by 100 to 150 animals.
That will triple the current population, but much more important, will add some genetic diversity to the mix. Bridgeland says that should help increase the marten's ability to boost their population even further by themselves. The old-fashioned way. I'm Dave Atkinson in the northeast corner of Cape Breton Highlands National Park.
You're listening to the Maritimes This Week. I'm Rob Dublay. Well, we're into the second week of December, and it seems to be getting darker earlier and earlier every day. And that makes us a little more lazy and a little more tired than we usually are. But if you're having trouble struggling to get up and go to work in the morning, you know what? We should be grateful that we don't have Brent Liston's job. Why, you ask? Well, he's a forest ranger with the Department of Natural Resources. Among his other 9-to-5 duties, Liston is responsible for removing dead animals from the sides of New Brunswick's highways. It's exactly what you would expect. It's backbreaking and smelly, and definitely not for the squeamish. But it's also an undervalued and important job that keeps New Brunswick roads clean and safe. New Brunswick's Angela Chang went along for the roadkill ride of her life and came back with this story.
Actually, we have 4 deer. Uh-huh. And plus the 5th year that you have.
It's 9:30 in the morning. Brent Liston and another forest ranger are dividing up the roadkill calls from last night. There is already a deer in the back of Liston's truck. It's covered with a stained white tarp.
Last night I got called at home. There was an injured deer in Burke's Corner. And I went to go look at that, and it appeared to have a broken neck. So, and it didn't look like it was going to make it, so I had to put that one down, and I have that with me now.
Small animals are picked up by the Department of Transportation's highway crew, but DNR is responsible for every moose, deer, and bear hit by cars and trucks. Every year, rangers pick up and dispose of about 400 animals in the Fredericton area alone. Brent Liston has been doing it for about 6 years.
I mean, it's always going to bother you, depending on, like I said, time of year. Like, there's some real nasty situations, one or two week old animals in July. But it's part of the job, and you have a job to do, so you just kind of grin and bear it.
Today, Liston has another 3 deer to pick up.
Probably Marysville first, okay. And then we'll head through Douglas and then out Masrell Summit way.
Sure, so what are we looking at?
We have, I believe, 3 dead deer on the side of the road. So it's not an emergency, but we'd like to get them picked up as soon as possible.
Large animals lying on the side of the road can be hazardous to drivers. They also attract other animals to the roadways, and they smell.
Summer days, there could be, roadkill that have been there for quite some time and goes undetected. And it could be there for a week or two before someone, they usually smell it, and we get called to go pick it up. So it can be quite disgusting. Should swing down here and look for it. Sometimes the directions aren't great.
Liston's first deer of the day is a buck lying on the shoulder of the road. It hasn't been dead long. Liston lowers the mesh gate on his truck and pulls on a pair of heavy leather gloves. He grabs the deer by the hind legs and drags it onto the truck bed. Deer are small enough that Liston can manage them on his own, but his truck also has a winch to help with larger animals. Liston makes a few notes on where the deer was found and prepares to pick up the next one.
I think we'll go to Douglas and pick up that one. And then we'll head off to Masrell Settlement and look after that one.
The second deer is not as easy to find. He drives up and down the road 3 or 4 times, but there's no sign of it.
Well, sometimes if it's hit, it'd be injured. Somebody will report it, and it may get up. Maybe just unconscious, or maybe okay, and eventually get up and wander in the woods. There's a possibility that someone has picked it up.
Picked it up to use it themselves. In the past, fresh roadkill animals were donated to food banks in the province. That practice was discontinued because the meat is not inspected. Liston says some people will take roadkill home to use as bait or to feed to their dogs.
I have come across roadkill deer that... Between the time it was reported and the time we were able to pick it up, that people would stop and remove the head just because it was a nice buck and had a decent-sized rack.
It may seem like members of the public are helping with the roadside cleanup, but it's actually illegal. Christian Moore is an enforcement officer.
The penalty would be $1,000. If convicted, the penalty is $1,000. 7 days in jail, and loss of hunting and fishing privileges for 5 years.
Moore says there is one exception, but it's pretty rare.
If you happen to be the person that hits the moose or deer with your own vehicle, and if you have a moose license or a deer license, and it's within legal hunting hours and within legal hunting season, if you actually kill the moose, you could put your moose tag, or if you kill the deer, put your deer tag on the animal and register it, through normal procedures, and that would be legal.
Hopefully people will see that and slow down a little bit. So.
Back on the road, Liston is looking for a third deer, and it's right where it's supposed to be. This one is in much worse condition, but it's the last one on his list. Liston hauls it into the back of the truck, and now he has to dispose of all the animals he's collected.
There are other areas, other ranger offices that will take maybe a moose or a deer to a zoo. If the zoo's willing to accept that animal, if it's in good condition, because they would feed that to the animals.
But you guys don't do that here?
Or no, we just take it out to Crown Land and to let the scavenging animals look after it and let it decompose naturally. We only need actual molars.
There is some gruesome work to be done before the deer are disposed of. Liston has to remove half of the jawbone from each deer.
And sometimes they remove easy and sometimes they don't.
He takes the jawbones back to the lab to find out how old the deer were and if they had any health problems. Liston takes his job very seriously. Even when he's not working, he often feels compelled to keep the highways and roads clear of roadkill.
If I'm on my own time, I will, if it's laying in the middle of the road or something, I'll move to the side of the road, just so the fact, because if it's any danger, public safety.
After Liston finishes cleaning up the roads, there's always one important stop to make before his day is over. He heads to the car wash to hose out his truck. For Information Morning, I'm Angela Chang.
Thursday, December 6th, marked the 90th anniversary of the Halifax explosion. This was a terrifying event that not only killed many of Nova Scotia's citizens and scarred the land, but also etched a permanent mark on the city's history. The explosion was caused when a French munitions ship called the Mont Blanc collided with a Norwegian ship in the narrows of Halifax Harbor. The Mont Blanc was loaded with explosives that were bound for the war in Europe. The blast flattened the north end of Halifax. It killed almost 2,000 people and injured more than 9,000 more. It was the largest non-nuclear man-made explosion in the world's history. Wilf Creighton was 13 years old that day. Today, his memory is still sharp at the age of 103. Earlier this week, Wilf took two modern-day 13-year-olds around Halifax to tell them what the explosion was like. Alex Zink and Anna Claire Lamport are both in grade 8 at Cornwallis Junior High School.
The morning of the explosion was a sunny day with just a little snow in the ground. I was upstairs with a geography book in my lap. We were going to have a geography test in grade 8. And all of a sudden, the house began to shake. Then it seemed to get dark, and there was a terrible crash, and the doors and windows came flying in. My father and mother were both in the kitchen, and we came out the front door, and we looked up the street, and we could see this great plume of white smoke. There were delivery wagons for bread and milk and so on, and the horses were running and the drivers were yelling. There was a woman just lived across the street. She had her hands up in the air. "My house is ruined. My house is ruined. Come and see my house." My father said, "Are your children all right?" "Yes." "Well, shut up about your house then." And cousin from the North End arrived, and she said, "Is Mama here?" And I said, "No." Well, she went in the house. Then my mother came out and told me the North End was flattened. And next morning, my cousin and I got up early and headed for the North End to see if we could find his bicycle that he had left up. So we will leave here and go up to North Barrington Street, where I'll explain what I saw up there.
We're down at the corner of Devonshire and Russell Street, down by the water.
We're by the harbour. There's a ton of cars going by. You can see the bridges.
What was it like when you came up with your friend to find the bicycle?
Well, it was a day very much like today. We saw the houses all flattened, wooden houses, and the ruins were burning, and there was a sickly, sweety smell that I can still smell. I didn't know what it was, but it was burning bodies in the building made that odor, disagreeable odor. And Halifax Fire Department had its first motorized pump, and that fire engine was sitting in the middle of Barrington Street. The top half of the steering wheel was missing. I think the whole crew had been killed, probably. And I knew two brothers were on their way to Richmond Street School when the explosion went off. One brother came too flying through the air, and he had a little tear in his stocking. The brother who had been beside him, they found his body but no head. At that time, we knew the Cretans were all gone, but we didn't know that we were looking for my mother's sister. My mother eventually found her body in the morgue 10 days after the explosion. But the undertakers just put her body as it was in a casket and sent it to our house. And oh, she was terribly bruised and dirty, and I can see my mother washing her sister's face and hair and trying to clean her up a little bit. It was a dreadful sight to watch.
It's really sad hearing about the flattened buildings and the burning people. It's kind of scary, too, because to think that this really happened to people and that so close to home.
It's hard to even believe that it happened. Like, there were so many horrible things happening under where we stood so many years ago, and it's so hard to relate to it because nothing even close to anything that's happened to us is anything like the Halifax explosion. So it's so hard to even think about it because it's just horrible, and people have had to go through it.
Oh, children are the same today as they were then. You were faced with it. You just had to fight to survive.
It's amazing to hear of the stories, and I really want to thank you for telling us.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and it's just amazing to have a first-hand account of what happened afterward.
Well, you're very welcome.
That was 103-year-old Wilf Creighton with Alex Zink and Anna Claire Lamport. They're both 13 years old. That is the exact same age that Wilf was during the time of the Halifax explosion. You've been listening to the Maritimes This Week, the best of CBC Radio on the East Coast. I'm Rob Dublay in Sydney. Now, if you'd like to comment on anything you've heard on the podcast, feel free to contact us at cbc.ca/podcasting. All podcasts are available from our website and also available on Sirius Satellite Radio on channel 137. You can catch another new episode of the Maritimes This Week next week as Rachel Cave takes the helm from New Brunswick. In the meantime, don't forget to tune into CBC Radio wherever you are.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.